You're looking puzzled, Steve McKay.
Yes, yes, there'd be a reason for that.
Lana Del Rey.
Ah, well, there you go. I'm just not quite as down with the kids as I thought I was.
Borrowing from Walt Whitman, a poem that sounds very lyrical there, but it goes on to talk about the thin red jellies within our bones and the body electric. Now, the reason we bring this up is we want to ask, are there favourite poems from your youth, ones you know lines of by heart? Tell you why in a minute.
"'Twas brillig and the slithy toes did gyre and gimble in the wave." Can't beat it, can you?
We've got a lot of contributions from listeners. "He saw the vision splendid of the sunlit plain extended." All their ones are rhyming. "And at night the wondrous glory of the everlasting stars." "Clancy of the overflow." And many more. Neil?
And "Xanadu did Kubla Khan a pleasure dome erect."
Stately.
It's also the start of a Frankie Goes to Hollywood album.
The Cree. Just editing your verse. A Cambridge University initiative is set to launch, aiming to find out what poetry stays with us, or in fact with you, Steve McKay, British people. It's the Poetry and Memories Survey, and the Dons will find out what poetry is stored in memory and what it means to the individuals who remember it. And I suppose it makes sense that older people will have more stored, because I don't know if they make you rote learn poetry at school these days.
Well, I think it depends on how broad a definition of the word poetry we're taking. I mean, it's kind of interesting that you had a song with poetic lyrics, because I'm going to guess that the youth of today, that's the poetry that they're going to be able to recite. They're not going to be able to tell you any Wordsworth, but they'll be able to give you something that is...
Eminem.
Okay, you're really stretching the point there. I mean, here's an example, right? The first one that came to mind. If you look at the Queen album, A Day at the Races, by the title of the song, "Tie Your Mother Down," there's actually a quote from the Times that described it as sheer bloody poetry. And that, okay, it's stretching it a tiny bit, I'll accept. But there is an awful amount of popular music lyric that you're not stretching too far to count as poetry.
You know, "'Twas brillig and Xanadu to Kubla Khan." Why do you remember the lines you have in your hippocampus? That's the question. What made you remember those lines?
Well, Jabberwocky, just because it's sublimely silly and delightful.
Okay.
Yes, I remember the Vorpal Blade. That always appealed to me as a child, the whole concept of a Vorpal Blade going snicker-snack.
Snicker-snack.
Yeah, so that was, I think there was a bit of the alliteration, and also, you know, it had a sword in it, so that was kind of cool when I was a kid. My one, yeah, it is really, it's a poem that I remember because it never got finished. So it was written in sort of a drug-induced haze, and he woke up halfway through and never actually really finished it. And it's sort of gone on to become part of music and part of other pieces of literature. And so it's this wonderful, brilliant, semi-finished work. It's like a painting that never got done.
And it's very traditional, and all the contributions from our listeners are traditional. "Sunset, an evening star, and one clear call for me," Tennyson, "Crossing the Bar." The Cambridge professor's essential question will be, what are the poems that live in people's memories at this moment in October 2014 when they kick it off? There you go. 24 minutes to five, what have the panellists been thinking about that they would like to mention? Steve McCabe.
Well, I've been thinking a little bit about something that happened to me at the train station a couple of days ago down in Pukekohe. As is my wont, I was boarding the train to work in Pukekohe, and I was handed a nicely prepared little booklet by a young lady in an Auckland Transport uniform, and so that was my on-the-train reading. He was talking about the new transport initiatives for connecting Pukekohe and Waiuku with the larger South Auckland area, and I realise this is potentially a little bit parochial for those of us who live in that area, but it's something that's really been weighing on my mind. They're talking about adding evening and weekend services to especially the Pukekohe train line, which is fantastic. We've been begging for this, mithering for it for ages, and they're doing it because they're now saying that they know that there's a bigger passenger load on that line. Fantastic, the penny's dropped. But what they do say in this document is, we've got a public consultation at the moment, but the idea of electrifying the train line as far as Pukekohe is not part of that discussion right now. It's not part of the current consultation. Basically, we don't want to talk about it. And when we ask, we're told, we'll think about it. And as I've said before, it's like when your mother says to you when you're a little kid, can I have this? And you say, I'll think about it. You know that means the answer is no, but I just don't want to have to tell you that right now. And that's basically what we keep getting, is we're thinking about it. We'll let you know later. And it's really grating at the moment. We are going to have finally, like I say, weekend services to the city. That's brilliant. But what we're suddenly going to miss out on now is a direct line from Pukekohe all the way to Britomart, which is at the moment a fantastic service, which I do use when I can. We're suddenly going to have to now get a rubbish diesel shuttle as far as Papakura, and then get the plush new electric trains all the way to Britomart. So when we come home, we'll get the electric trains as far as Papakura, and then we'll be reminded this is as far as the love stretches. The rest of you, you get your diesel back. So we are actually getting a downgraded service. The rest of Auckland, you lot get your fancy new electric trains from Spain. We're getting these dodgy diesels that routinely break down and just not as nice a service. Instead, they're now trying to actually get us onto the buses. And why are we focusing on bus transport when everyone else is, you know, we're trying to get into trains, it's much more efficient, it's much more clean, it's much more sustainable energy. They're sticking us on buses. This is a huge step backwards. And really, what needs to be happening, especially as they're also talking in the same breath about all these new special housing areas around Pukekohe, give us electric trains, please. We will use them.
Money only stretches so far, Steve.
It stretches as far as Papakura. Judith Collins constituency.
Don't be too dismissive of Eminem, says Graham. There are essays online comparing his grasp of poetic meter to Shakespeare.
I was actually being serious about that. I think actually if you look at his lyrics, his rhyme scheme and his cadence is really quite remarkable.
And also, he was good enough for the National Party, says Graham.
It's, in the words of Stephen Joyce, I'm pretty sure that was pretty legal.
Steve McCabe, thank you. Neil Miller, what's on your mind, please?
Well, as you know, I usually try to crowdsource my topics for this, which is why last time I was on your show, I ended up talking about professional wrestling. But this time, my friends got organised and have forced me to address a very good topic. And the topic is, how do you survive an election as a couple when you support diametrically opposed parties?
Oh.
And this was put on my Facebook by my girlfriend, who supports a diametrically opposed party. And so I agreed to have a go at it. And it's interesting. I mean, I think what you do, if you're in a relationship, a family relationship, a romantic relationship, a friendship relationship, and politics are a difference, it can be an issue sometimes. But what I think you need to focus on is look at the issues, look at the policies, look at what's really happening. Don't sort of speculate about what's going on in the background. Try to find things that you agree about, things that you both like or you both dislike, and Kim.com was quite useful in that particular aspect of disliking. But, you know, recognize that there are good people in all parties and that there's well-intentioned policies in pretty much all parties, and focus on those. But, you know, recognizing that there'll be some differences of opinion. My number one piece of advice would be don't gloat. Because while you're on top for a while, you'll be on the bottom. And that's going back to sort of the 1999 to 2005 experience that I had working in Parliament. You know, things change and it's not usually on merit. There are cycles and people just get to a stage where they say, well, this government's had enough of a chance. We need to move on to the next one. So, you know, there's elements outside of the control of the politicians. And the final thing that I would say is that politics can be an important part of people's lives, and it should be something that they think about, but it's only part of their life. It's when you're thinking about someone as a friend or a partner, it's really no more important than if they're left or right-handed, if they're still a good person, a person that you like, the person you have a lot in common with. And so, yeah, politics has its place, but it shouldn't be a divisive force. Even though this election was probably one of the nastier ones that we saw in general.
It's funny because people have been commenting as you've been talking, and Rachel Blake is saying, but your values are not the same, surely, if you subscribe to different views on the political spectrum.
Well, I mean, we have a lot in common. We both support, for example, same-sex marriages. You know, there are a lot of commonalities between most political parties. You know, we would differ more probably on a lot of the economic stuff than on the social stuff, because I'm a dry economically but very liberal socially.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can find these areas of common ground.
I routinely vote, says a texter, to cancel my wife's vote. This election, the wife voted green, so I voted for Colin Craig. And Karen from Waterview, for you, Steve, says you need more of the Auckland Transport bosses living out your way using the service.
That's a good point.
Yeah, that would work, yeah.
Now, a staged plan for Pike River has been agreed on, as we know, for a while. And the news has emerged that Pike River was safe, in inverted commas, to enter a year ago. An Official Information Act release has revealed WorkSafe New Zealand and Mines Rescue's advice to Solid Energy was that it was technically feasible to re-enter the mine. So why hasn't a recovery operation started? And the CEO of Solid Energy, Dan Clifford, was scheduled to have a media conference on this. And we'll be speaking to Dan Clifford on Checkpoint tonight, and also soon to the Pike River family's spokesman, Bernie Monk. Tony Ryle, the Minister of State-Owned Enterprises, has today said the decision of when the mine will be entered is Solid Energy's to make, not WorkSafe New Zealand's. But the proposal to re-enter the mine's been beset by delays, the latest of which was when Solid Energy announced potentially fatal risks still needed to be examined before attempting to enter. But the OIA documents revealed that there were no safety or operational barriers to re-entry, and that had been WorkSafe's and Mines Rescue's advice since October 2013. Bernie Monk will tell us more, but what was your reaction when you heard this, first of all, your initial comments?
Well, you have to accept that this has already been an enormous tragedy. 20-some people have died. The only way that this could possibly get worse would be for more people to die in the same mine. And in the end, it's clearly a dangerous place. That's obvious. Sending people down there again is impossible to guarantee safety. Absolutely impossible. You're asking people to go into a mine which is inherently unsafe and take an enormous risk in doing so. Is it not possibly just too much of a risk?
All right, but WorkSafe, Mines Rescue, the Pike River Reentry Group, they all say it can proceed.
But other people are saying, are we sure?
Well, it'll never be wholly safe, will it? You can never guarantee total safety.
And the stakes are extraordinarily high.
Neil?
Yeah, I'm no expert in this issue at all, but I think the reference to technically feasible indicates that they think it can be done, but is hinting at that level of risk, which I think Steve was alluding to there. But yeah, it is a bit disappointing that if the families have been told that it's too dangerous to go in and these reports have been sitting there in the background, I think they're right to be disappointed and should have their questions answered.
Not just technically feasible, but also identified no operational barriers to re-entry, I think was the phrase. Let's talk to Bernie Monk, who, of course, has been the face of the Pike River families for nearly 4 years now, kindly joining us again. Bernie, good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon to you.
So there's been a press release from Solid Energy, which you may have seen. If not, I can quote it to you. But what do you think of their latest pronouncement about this?
Well, they haven't said anything, have they? They haven't said anything more than we've known. And the most frustrating part about this, I'm telling you now that mine is more safer than the mines that they're actually mining in New Zealand.
You've known for ages, haven't you, that it was safe enough, in inverted commas, or as safe as it can be. Is that your attitude?
Yes, it is.
Okay, and given that this kind of operation can never be guaranteed safe, where would the possible danger, Bernie, come from? Now, rock fall, gas, what's your understanding?
Well, we're making that mine that safe. You know, before anyone even goes into the mine, it's unbelievable. We've done more risk assessments on that mine than we can ever have done on anything else in New Zealand. And it's just unforgivable what's been happening here. And we've had to go through this day in and day out, meeting after meeting after meeting, and listen to all this stuff that gets thrown down our throat. And we've known all the time, and our experts said, listen, Bernie, it takes you 6 to 8 months to do the risk assessments, 6 to 8 weeks to do the risk assessments on such a small mine like Pike, and it's taken them nearly 2 years. It's beyond a joke. And why they won't tell us, well, I went to a meeting with them, and Dan, he was the man, and we asked him. We said to him, now, Dan, tell us what the risk assessments are so we can put it into the hands of our experts to help you get through these. Oh, no, I can't answer that question. Oh, when are you going to, when are you going to actually, what time length are you going to give us before you can tell us what is the results of these risk assessments? Oh, no, I can't tell you that either. So we've had no cooperation at all with them.
Well, where is their legal liability advice, their health and safety advice coming from,
do
you
think? That's what we want to know. We want to know who are the people that are actually giving them this advice. I know who they are, but I want them to tell me, and they won't tell us.
Okay, so if you know who they are, what do you think of the quality of their advice when it lines up against the attitude of WorkSafe, Mines Rescue and the Reentry Assessment Group?
Well, if I go right back to day one, when Solid Energy first took the mine over, they came to the families and said, this mine could never be entered ever again for at least 15 years. Anyway, I thought about this, and they come and see me here at my hotel, at my home here, and I sat down with them, and I had a gut feeling, all right? So I rang them up about 3 days later, and I said, can you give me all the data of how you came about of coming up with the assumption that this mine could never be entered? And they, you know what they said to me? They never had any. They never had any data. So these people are the same people that are making the risk assessments and everything, they've got no intentions of wanting to do this job. And they'll have egg on their faces. It was only when we brought our guys over from the UK that this started up again. We got independent people away from Australians and everyone else that have been making the calls. And as soon as we brought an independence from the UK and sat down and made things happen, that we got things to happen, and then we've been shut out ever since.
They're talking about the preliminary risk assessment from August 2013, and since the preliminary risk assessment, the board's advisor recommended further risk assessment, which was completed in July, more detailed examination of all the risks which could lead to serious injury. But, I mean, along the way, you have talked with them about another borehole being needed or some rock-shoring device needed to be put in. I mean, so you've been privy to some of that, haven't you?
We've been privy to everything, but all when we just about get to the stage where we're just going to do the re-entry, the goalposts get changed. And then, no, we can't do it.
What do you think of the way they have communicated with you and the families of the 29?
Well, look, we have meetings with them every 2 weeks, and we really appreciate that. But we don't get the only way that we're ever going to get this out in the open is to sit round a table with our experts and their experts and nut it out, and then put it out in the open where it should be put out all from day one. And you can think about all the information that we've had over the years, and we've sat round the table, things have moved forward swiftly. As soon as they go into a shell and do it themselves, we go through these long periods of this month, next month, the next month, the next month, and it just continues. And I can see this dragging on even till next year if we don't sit down and face each other face to face.
Why won't they give you the detail about the legal advice they've had and who they've talked to and what the specific concerns are beyond broad general health and safety issues?
Well, you'd have to ask Dan that.
Well, we probably will ask Dan that.
But he said he can't comment.
But you guys must talk about it a lot, and I'm wondering if you formed any conclusions about why this ongoing delay, which you think will just keep on going.
Well, I've talked to a lot of people, and even the government at loggerheads are as frustrated as we are about the way this has been handled.
All right, Bernie, thank you very much for joining us again. Bernie Monk for the Pike River Families at 5:09. Well, having heard that, Steve McCabe, I mean, and acknowledging that the board keeps citing health and safety issues and the safety of people going back down, as you said, do you still think that it's an odd sort of situation when you hear Bernie Monk describe that?
There's one thought that comes to mind that I realise will possibly upset quite a few people within the Pike River community if I say it, but I mean it with the greatest possible respect. Is it absolutely necessary at this stage to recover the bodies of the 29 victims? I understand that there is an enormous emotional urge to do so, but it seems like this is now an absolute, dare I say it, tunnel vision fixation on, we have to do this, we have to do this, we have to do this. Is it entirely necessary? Is it possible to step back and look at it and think, maybe it's not worth it?
Yeah, but you do get to close an unfinished chapter in your life, and you might feel differently if you had a son.
Oh, quite possibly. I realise I'm at a huge, enormous emotional distance from this, and I'm not part of it. And that's why I say I'm being very careful in how I word this, because I don't want to sound callous. I can't imagine what it must be like to be in that position. But from this distance, the last thing I would want to see happen is more people dead down there.
All right. It is 5:07. We were speaking yesterday about the huge terror raids in Australia and how everyone has been released now, pretty much, except the one bloke who took the phone call and was harangued about choosing an innocent victim to decapitate. Just a general chat about this topic. The idea, says Peggy Klemenko of Kandala, that ISIS would use so unsophisticated a method as the phone to organise events of this sort is deluded. Actually, that thought has occurred to other people, but maybe they did. I do think, she says, that what we're looking at in Iraq and Syria is a sectarian war, and we should keep well out of it, even if we are being forced to watch atrocities being committed. No matter how well-intentioned Australian or Western in general intervention may be, it is likely to make things worse and life less secure for us all. Do you have sympathy with that view?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, there is a degree to which the US has to take a lot of responsibility for what's going on in the region now, given that the US destabilised the region in the first place. I mean, I'm not saying that it was a good situation that existed before, but it possibly wasn't as dreadful as the situation that exists now in Iraq, for example.
Sure, okay.
And so, yeah, the US possibly has an obligation to try and do something. Maybe the airstrikes they're pulling off right now aren't the ideal way, though.
Okay, well, let's get to that. There's an American general, I think, quoted this morning about how we can expect a bitter decade of terrorism and war. And, of course, we've also had a bitter decade and a half of terrorism and war. And it's reported now that more than a third of the US airstrikes in Syria weren't aimed at ISIS, but against a lesser-known al-Qaeda cell, the Khorasan group, and it poses the more immediate threat to the West, apparently, and it recruits jihadists with Western passports, intending to send them back into the West and to create havoc. And there is no reason to doubt this, but at the same time, it's puzzling, the rapidity with which it all changes. Are you reminded, in some sense, of 1984? You know, announcements of the new enemy, super surveillance to keep us straight and to keep us safe and on the straight and narrow. Does that occur to your mind at all?
I'm reminded of much earlier than that. You know, I grew up in England in the 1970s with a family with an Irish background, and we used to visit Northern Ireland intermittently to visit family, and this was during the Troubles, and the terrorism that we were dealing with in Britain as part of that, especially in Northern Ireland, was daily and ongoing, and we weren't constantly told about the latest terror threat and which cell was likely to be doing this and which faction of the Republicans or the Unionists were going to be doing what kind of attack next. It was dealt with. It was in the background. It wasn't constantly discussed, and we weren't constantly reminded of this terrible terror threat that we were living under.
Understand. But now, so we got lots more information now.
Yeah. What we've actually got is FUD. We've got fear, uncertainty, doubt, and drama. And it makes for great media, great television, but all it does is it frightens people unnecessarily.
Neil Miller, a bright cold day in April and the clocks were striking 13. Does it remind you, I mean, the idea this is going to go on and on and on, it's a concern, isn't it?
Well, yes, definitely. And I think what we're seeing is that the terrorist threat can adapt quicker than the responses to it. And so, you know, in the aftermath of 9/11, the countries were looking out for a particular profile of people. And, you know, let's be frank, they were racial profiling, and it was based on where you were born, where you're from, your religion, from birth. But now we're seeing that both in Britain and in Australia, some of the terrorists, some of those involved in groups associated with terrorism, they speak with the same accents as their neighbours. And so it's a very different kind of beast that's evolved quite quickly. It's an insider rather than an outsider threat. And so that's why I think surveillance will continue at a very high level. Because I think these organisations have shown that they will find different ways to inflict terror, crashing planes or beheading people in public.
The reason for the Orwell question isn't that the surveillance isn't necessary, because a lot of people think it is, but the sadness of the surveillance, does that aspect, looking at your life down the track and the lives of your children, etc., does that worry you?
I think so. I think, you know, there's the idea that, you know, everywhere you go now, you'll be on CCTV and that it's going to be stored somewhere, I think is scary. That, you know, there is a very little anonymity these days, and you have to weigh up whether that's a price that you're willing to pay.
But Neil, you did quite nicely make Jim's 1984 point for him when you referred to the terrorist threat and how it modifies and evolves and develops. The people who are being considered the terrorist threat today are very different from the people who considered the terrorist threat back in 2001. And yet, we are at war with Eurasia. We have always been at war with Eurasia. And we are at war with terror. We will always be at war with terror. And it's terror is currently just a very, very convenient excuse for whatever action needs to be taken.
All right, the woman, just before we go, thank you for your thoughts on that. The woman who was the intended victim of that bag snatch in Auckland has come forward to police and will be interviewed with the help of an interpreter. And the woman who interviewed to help her is stable in Auckland Hospital now after brain surgery. Lucy Knight, hit on the head by the assailant who tried the bag snatch outside the Countdown in Northcote. The question, just quickly before we go, the question of when to intercede and when not to. She was obviously very brave. What do you think, or what do you like to think, that you would do in these kinds of situations?
I would like to think that I would try to help. I'm not that confident that I would be as brave as this woman would be.
Yeah, and we're Neil. Yeah, you'd like to think that you'd step up, wouldn't you, really? You got these grandiose notions, oh, I would definitely come running forward and I would be a brave knight in shining armour, and the reality is, nah.
The one time I came close was I saw a couple of people running out of a supermarket and being chased by an employee, and I was getting ready to sort of like shoulder check the second one, and at the last minute they ran across the road and I missed them. And I found out later that was the store detective chasing the thief. And so I would have been like quite a terrible knight in shining armour in that particular instance.
The thought was there.
Yeah, it was. And thankfully the execution wasn't.
Steve and Neil are talking too much sense. They must be taken off the radio immediately, says Troy Smithers, before this catches on. There
Excellent.
You go.
We've done a good job, Neil.
Yeah, I'm surprised
right.
as well.
You've got votes from one listener. Just before we go, the political advantages in changing the flag. We're going to be talking about this for the next year now. I mean, do you want the flag changed?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, when I do go to Europe, I'll probably have a silver fern on my bag.
I change all of it except the top left-hand corner.
That's the worst part of it.
were talking sense until then, Neil. Seriously.
The trouble will come from people disagreeing with you about the silver fern. You know this.
Yep, I can live with that.
All right. Neil Miller, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
We'll talk to you before your trip. And Steve McCabe, always a pleasure to have you on too.
Thank you.
That's the panel for another day. Thank you, everybody. And Checkpoint is on the way.